I did not plan this to happen. It just sort of happened. We talked about, at least briefly in Bible class, the concept of the kingdom, and then here we are in Hebrews chapter 12, discussing the better kingdom. Now, it is true that God has consistently demonstrated that he deals with people in a mix of individual and collective ways. That is to say, that you can have a relationship with God individually, but God has consistently demonstrated that he wants his people to be together. He wants each individual to be part of a collective whole. Now, as we come into the Old Testament and into the New Testament, that there's an idea that there is a kingdom in Israel, and Israelites, they had all their sacrificial laws and they had all the ordinances, and the Israelites really did need each other because the individual Israelites were not allowed to offer sacrifice, right? They needed the priesthood and all the different things, and they needed to be a part of the kingdom. And so as we come into the new covenant, there is a similar idea of togetherness, of a collective group. Now, for the most part, as we've looked through the book of Hebrews, there's been a lot of differences, right? Differences between things in the Old Covenant and things in the New Covenant. But there's not a lot of radically different things. What do I mean by that? For the most part, Jesus fulfilled and became the best version of many of these Old Testament roles. That is to say, the job itself has not drastically changed, but Jesus has been the best fulfillment of these same ideas. And we could think about any number of these. Angels as messenger, Aaron as priest, Moses as lawgiver. Well, in the new covenant, there's still a messenger. There's still a priest. There's still a lawgiver. But Jesus does all these things way better than anybody did in the old covenant. The systems of the new covenant are perfected versions of the old, right? The sacrificial system, there's still a system of sacrifice in the new covenant, but Jesus has done that best. He's done it as best as it could possibly be done. The means of atonement, all the sacrifices of atonement in the Old Testament. Again, those didn't go away. They were fulfilled. They were most perfectly realized in Jesus, who did the same thing, only better, right? The responsibilities of the people involved. We have some responsibilities, guys. Now, there may be a little bit of difference between what we're doing in the new covenant versus the old, but we worship, we offer our lives as sacrifice, we follow God's laws, we do all these things, even though the things we're doing is the best possible version of the things that God wants us to do. So, as we think about the better things in Hebrews, these are fulfillments and the best possible versions of the way that God interacts with man. In addition to the individual aspects of a relationship with God, we need to do the right things, we need to have a personal relationship, we need to be immersed in baptism, all these individual things that go on, there is still a collective part, a group part of this new covenant. And it's actually most clearly seen in baptism, because what can you not do? You can't baptize yourself. Right? The idea of being baptized, the passive form of that word, to be baptized, be immersed into Christ, automatically implies that there's going to be another person. That even though we have this individual relationship with God, as the Old Testament Israelites did, there was a group or a collective part of that relationship with God. And so God deals with people in a mix. Individual, yes, the individual personal relationship that you have with God, but then the collective part of that responsibility, of that relationship. We see it in communion as well. What did Jim say? That we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes? That's a collective act, right? Who are we proclaiming it to? We're proclaiming it to each other. We're proclaiming it to the world. But there's a group activity. This is a thing that they gathered together to do, right? They didn't do it on their own. In fact, Paul was very upset with them when they did it on their own. Now, to make this point in Hebrews, the author draws from the story of Israel's origin as a nation, the events on Mount Sinai. I don't know how familiar you are with the events in Mount Sinai. They come out of the land of Egypt, the parting of the sea, right? And they go through on dry land, and then they travel around in the desert for a while, and eventually they come to Mount Sinai. This mountain in the peninsula, or not the peninsula, between the two legs of the Red Sea, you kind of had the sea that goes up on the left and the sea that goes up on the right. And in the middle, there was this mountain, Mount Sinai. As they crossed through the Red Sea, they came to this mountain. And what did God do there? This is where he gave them the law. This is where they really, as a nation, became something of God's kingdom. This is when God said, for officially the first time, these are the things I want you to do as members of my kingdom. And this is where the Mosaic Covenant started, in Mount Sinai. And what is he making? What question is he answering? What makes God's kingdom today better than the kingdom back then? As he draws from this story of Mount Sinai, he's answering this question. How is God's kingdom today better than God's kingdom of Israel? The kingdom that they had, the kingdom they received at Mount Sinai, how is ours better? Because as we've talked about in Hebrews over and over and over again, the better things that we've been given, that's the point of the book. And as I could put these back up there, right? The better sacrificial system, the better means of atonement, the better responsibilities, the better priest, the better lawgiver, all these better things. So the group thing is better too. The kingdom that we have received. Number one, we're going to see three things. The kingdom of Israel was physical versus the spiritual kingdom that we have received. Hebrews 12, 18 through 21, the first part of what was read. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet with a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. The imagery of this verse is so great, right? The tangible things that he's describing, gloom and fire and darkness and the sound of the voice, right? Oh, please don't say anything else. That the voice was so strong and so powerful that they begged not to have any more spoken. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned, right? This physical location. And Moses went up on the mountain and he received all the things from God. And what did God say? Don't approach this mountain. Do not cross this line. I don't know if they drew a line around or not. If you even a beast, a camel or a horse or whatever, even if a beast walks up there accidentally, it's going to die. This physical location, indeed so terrifying was the sight that even Moses said, I tremble with fear. This thing, what may be touched, a thing of this world. And at Mount Sinai, it was a physical location, right? The mountain. But then that would carry forward. This physical location of Israel and the promised land, the whole concept of the promised land, right, was that they were going to go into the land of promise. They didn't get there for a while because of some rebellion. But they eventually got there to this land of Israel, and that was the place that God's people were, and there was a physical location for the Ark of the Covenant. It was a thing of this world. Of course, the mountain was a physical location, Sinai, and that's what he's talking about in these verses. Contrasted with what? But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Now, note, first of all, that we have come to it, not will come in the future, but we have come to this place, this thing, this kingdom that God has set up for us. And this is one of the things I want to talk about as we got into in class. The idea of better things in Hebrews, the fulfillment of these Old Testament ideas, we have come to the kingdom now. The kingdom that we are currently in. And the way that he describes this is interesting. Mount Zion, I think that's an interesting comparison in this particular story. Now, there was a Mount Zion, but the story that he's drawing from, the story of Mount Sinai, this mountain that people could not even touch and could not even be on, and it was gloomy and dark and fire and everything, but this mountain that you have come to, not that at all, not anything like that, to the city of the living God. Well, which city? Are we talking about Jerusalem? And he does, in fact, say Jerusalem, not the physical location of Jerusalem, right? But the heavenly Jerusalem, something spiritual, not an actual place. You don't have to go over to Israel and find it. It is this heavenly thing, this spiritual thing in nature. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking, for if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, at Sinai, right? Don't do all these bad things and fulfill my law. And if you do the things that I've said, then it'll go well for you. And if you don't do the things that I've said, then it'll be bad for you. Much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. That God is not on earth someplace warning us. This idea of warning from heaven, and I think the whole book of Hebrews sort of ties this idea together. God, who at many times in many ways spoke in times past by the prophets, has now in these last days spoken to us by his Son, who came from heaven, who has now ascended back into heaven. But there is an interesting idea here, that this kingdom, as Jesus promised, is not a thing of this earth. Wasn't that their problem in the Old Testament? Or not the Old Testament, the Gospels. Wasn't that their problem? One of the reasons they couldn't see Jesus for who he was is that he did not promise to lead them into this grand restoration of the kingdom of Israel, that they would drive out the Romans and that everything would be great on earth. Therefore, because the kingdom is not a physical thing, what? It can't be invaded or destroyed. Where would anybody invade? Where would anybody go if they wanted to destroy it? It remains pure, even if we are corrupt. And you might say, well, they'll go to the church and they'll destroy the church and they'll corrupt the church. But if everyone in this room forsook God, the kingdom would remain pure. We just wouldn't be in it, right? We just wouldn't be in it anymore. This idea that it's a spiritual, it's not somewhere you can go and corrupt and destroy, but it persists because it is spiritual. And if we are corrupt, if we do the wrong things, if we decide not to follow God, God will just remove us from it. And because it's not a physical thing, he can just do that instantly, and it just happens. It doesn't have to move us from here to Arizona, right? He just takes us out. The second thing, because of the nature of this kingdom, it is exclusive versus inclusive. Well, I should say, I phrased these the wrong way. I put them the wrong way. The old covenant, the old kingdom was exclusive versus the new covenant, which is inclusive, the new kingdom. And what did he do in all these things in Hebrews 12, 18 through 21? What was the whole point of Mount Sinai? Only Moses could go up, but even Moses didn't really get to see. And even the things that he saw, he was so terrified of. Right? They could not bear the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. The holiness of God excluded the masses. And then later, even to an extent, Moses, right? Even Moses didn't get to see the fullness of God. And even later, when we come to the temple in Jerusalem, there was the Ark of the Covenant, but only one person could go in, and only one day a year. The rest of the people did not get to go into God's presence. They were excluded from that presence of God. They did not get to participate in that. One guy, one time a year, which we've talked about at length in Hebrews, the holiness of God under the old covenant, the old kingdom, was exclusive. Yet we come now to us, and what do we find? But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to heavenly Jerusalem, innumerable angels in festal gathering, the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The contrast between Sinai and the new kingdom is stay back at Sinai versus come and join me in the new covenant, that we, with many other places in Hebrews, we're not going to read them all that we've already read, but many places in Hebrews that we're told to approach with boldness the throne of God. And I'm not going to a physical location, right? It's not that I go to Jerusalem and find the throne of God and I go in and I physically enter. What does that mean? That I'm spiritually entering into God's presence. And because this kingdom is spiritual in nature, not physical, I can do that. I can approach his presence with boldness. I am included in this. Look at this gathering language, right? We've got a festal gathering. We've got the assembly of the firstborn. All of these together things, the togetherness of this assembly, as opposed to the kingdom of Israel that was exclusive. A, you had to be there in the kingdom. That's why they all came on the day of Pentecost, right? In Acts chapter 2, they all had to travel to Jerusalem because that's where it was. And they were excluded by the laws and ordinances from entering into God's presence based on the priesthood and all the different ordinances and sacrifices and et cetera, et cetera. But now we have come to the perfect version of this, and none of us are excluded from that presence unless we exclude ourselves, which we'll talk about in a moment. Now, it is interesting to note, of course, and this is sort of the point I was trying to drive at in class, that there still is a level of separation that we experience, because I'm limited by my physical body. I'm limited by that. This binds me, this shell, this vessel. There is a time, there's going to be a time where I experience that even more fully, right? There's going to be a time where even this shell, this limited barrier that I have, my senses and my sight and my sound and all that, that's going to be removed, even that barrier between me and God, and I will experience him in the complete fullness of all things. That is even a time that we're looking forward to from now, the future. While I'm in the kingdom, I'm in God's kingdom now, there's so much limitations in the physical. And I really do long for the day when I do not experience God through my physical shell, that I get to experience him as perfectly as possible. From the institution of this new covenant, The goal has been to open the kingdom to all, hasn't it? Isn't that the whole point of Acts chapter 2? Acts chapter 2, we have all these nations gathered together, and Peter preaches this great sermon, and they all go back, and they all tell their friends about it. And then we come to Acts chapter 10, right? Somehow they didn't get it between Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 10. They still weren't going to the Gentiles. They were still only going to the Jews, physically Jews, right? They still had this physical idea in their head. Acts chapter 10, what happens? Peter goes to Cornelius. Well, really, Cornelius sends for Peter, right? They both have these, God tells them to do various things, and Peter eventually goes to Cornelius, and what does Peter realize? I realize now that God is not a respecter of persons, but in any nation, whoever does what is pleasing to him is acceptable in his sight. That this kingdom has now been opened to everyone. The third thing, then, the temporary nature of the old kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, the old covenant kingdom, versus the permanent nature of ours. And remember, as I said, because it is spiritual in nature, what's going to happen to it to destroy it? Who has the power or the ability to do that? Hebrews 12, 25 through 27. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking, for if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on the earth, what does that mean? What is that saying? Did not escape. What did they not escape? They didn't escape the destruction of Jerusalem, right? The exiles, the captivities. All these things at Sinai that God said, if you do these things, then it'll be well with you, and if you don't do these things, then your kingdom will be lost. And eventually it was lost. They did not escape because they resisted his word. The exiles happened, and then eventually, of course, in 70, even the Romans came in and destroyed the temple. It's never been restored, and that is very clearly over and done with. They did not escape those who warned them on earth. Much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. At that time, his voice shook the earth. This is on Sinai, right? But now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken. That is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. Now, what does this mean, this phrase here, yet once more? What does that mean? One more time. And this is what I mean about this future thing that we're looking forward to, right? Once more indicates the removal of things that are shaken, things that are temporary in nature, things that are not permanent, things that can be destroyed, things that have been made. My body, this earth, this building, everything that's physical, made up of matter, these things that are made in order that the things that cannot be shaken, what? The permanent kingdom of God. That thing that cannot be destroyed. You might step out of it. You might remove yourself from it. You might not want to be a part of it, but you cannot destroy it. You cannot shake it. You cannot remove it. You cannot incapacitate it. You have no power over that kingdom. That thing that cannot be shaken will remain as all the physical things are destroyed. Yet once more I will shake even the foundations of the earth. Peter talks about it in more clear language in 2 Peter chapter 3, right? The heavenly bodies will be dissolved, the planets will be dissolved, and the works that are done on them will be exposed. So as we think about this comparison, him who warns from earth, God on Sinai, if you don't follow my laws, if you don't do the things that I have commanded you, then that kingdom will be stripped from you, as it was the kingdom of Israel. What's the warning for us? If they didn't escape him who warned on earth, how would we think we would escape him who warns from heaven? Not that the kingdom will be destroyed, but we will be destroyed. We will be removed. We will be punished. God, we are living in God's kingdom now, and it is far better than it has ever been, and it will still yet in the future be better than it is now. There is a progression in the Bible, a progression from things being okay to things being great to things finally being perfect. And I really look forward to that day when things are perfect, even though I live in the kingdom now and it is better than it ever has been. I look forward to when things that have been made are removed, that I don't have to live with this earthly physical shell. Maybe I'm the only one who looks forward to that. However, one thing has stayed the same, and it stayed the same in each iteration of God's kingdom, and it'll stay the same in the final iteration of God's kingdom, right? The thing that has stayed the same is what? Hebrews 12, 21, indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. What sight? The sight of God's presence. God himself, Yahweh, the great I am. His sight was so, and the word terrible there, that idea terrifying, what? That it was overwhelming to him emotionally. It was so strong and so powerful that he was terrified of it. What does Hebrews say about us, our kingdom? Let us therefore be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. Why? For our God is, not was, is a consuming fire. God has not changed from kingdom to kingdom. The ruler of that kingdom is the same ruler that rules over this kingdom. And he is, as both in both contexts described, a terrifying being. One who is a consuming fire. One who deserves, and it's interesting what he says there, because we have received this awesome thing, this better thing, this kingdom that we've received, what should be our reaction to that? What should we do about that? Let us offer to God acceptable worship because he deserves it. He is so awesome. He is so powerful. He is so amazing. Why would I do anything but worship him? Those people back then, they couldn't figure that out somehow. And the warning is the same for us. Don't be like them who couldn't figure it out, who did not escape him who warned. Be like the people who, in chapter 11, he described, right? All those people in chapter 11 who did what God wanted them to do and were rewarded for that thing. His judgment has not changed either, has it? The promise that he made to them, if you do not accept my words and follow them, I will remove you. That judgment has not changed, nor the consequences for rebellion. As you think about the kingdom, you're in it. I hope you're in it now. I really hope you're in the kingdom. But at the end, when all things are removed, the things that are shaken are removed, the consequence for rebellion remains the same. You might find yourself no longer in that kingdom, no longer a part of that great and awesome thing that God has given to his people. Even though it is inclusive rather than exclusive, there still are some limitations on who can be included in that, right? The limitations have been lessened and in some ways removed between the Jews and the Gentiles, but you still have to follow the things that God has said. So the conclusion, three questions that we're going to end with. Why do people look so much to the restoration of the former kingdom, the kingdom of Israel? Why do people want that? As I look about Hebrews 12 and I read Hebrews 12, I see the great things that God has given to us. I do not want to go back to the old thing. I don't want to go back to that physical kingdom. I don't want to have to travel over there to Israel. I'm glad that wherever I am at any moment, I can enter into the presence of God. Aren't you glad about that? Amen. I'm glad that I can enter his presence at any moment, wherever I am, if I'm flying in a plane, if I'm traveling on a boat, if I'm sitting in my house. I can enter into the presence of God. Why would I want to restore that old limited thing? Second, even though I think we understand that, I still think we get confused about the nature of our kingdom sometimes. We get mixed up in the idea of the physical versus the spiritual, right? This building is not the kingdom. Say it with me. This building is not the kingdom. You don't have to say it, it's fine. What's the kingdom? Wherever God's people are, that's the kingdom. If this building were destroyed tomorrow by a tornado, which could happen, the kingdom would still exist, right? It's not this building, it's not this city, it's not this nation, it's not this whatever. It is not bound by physical borders that man has set up. It's not bound by anything. I think we sometimes get confused with that. If we didn't have a building, we could still worship in the kingdom. We could go to somebody's house. We could do it out in this field for all that matters. We'd still be in the kingdom of God. We need to be careful not to be confused about the nature of our kingdom. The same thing with exclusive versus inclusive, right? I think sometimes we put limits on, that person's never going to be a part of the kingdom. I'm not going to go talk to that person. They don't really deserve to be in the kingdom. Who are you to say that? You're not God. You have no idea. Your responsibility is to try to include everybody, and they make their own choice. But your responsibility is to try to be as inclusive as possible in the kingdom. What is your attitude finally towards your ruler, towards God? He is a God that loves. He is a God that gives and blesses and a God full of grace. But that God that appeared to Moses in the gloom and the tempest and the fire on Sinai, that's still your God. And he has those sides to him. The gracious, loving, merciful side and the wrathful, consuming side. And what is your attitude towards him? How do you conceive of your ruler? What about your fellow members of the kingdom? Right? We're all members together. Do we act like that? or are we just all trying to do it on our own? Do we act like we're part of the same group? What about towards those who are not yet in it? How do you perceive them? What do you think about them? Just consider your reaction to those who are not in the kingdom. My invitation is quite simple. The kingdom of God has arrived. And there is a brief window of time, I don't know how long, where you can choose to be a part of that kingdom now on earth. There will be a time, eventually, where God's kingdom will be fully realized and you can no longer choose to be a part of it. That time of choice will be over. My invitation is quite simple. Choose to be a part of the kingdom while you still have time, because I don't know how long you have.